Hello, good evening, hi. I am Michael Moseley, and I'm here to moderate. We are talking today about the future of medicine, and someone once said, predicting is a difficult business, particularly when it's about the future. I used to work on Tomorrow's World. Anyone remember Tomorrow's World? And we made lots of predictions, most of them wrong. Unfortunately, a few of us are flying around in our personal helicopters at the moment, or indeed have organs from transgenic pigs. In medicine, and indeed in science generally, in fact, most of the predictions have tended to underestimate the rate of advance. So that famously in 1957, the Astronomer Royal said, space is bunk, and this was 2 weeks before Sputnik. I talked to a very, very prominent scientist, whose name I will not mention, who said that cloning of mammals was decades away, and this was, again, 2 weeks before Dolly the sheep. We are going to be taking questions. We love questions, but if we could save them towards the end. So, the next person up is Professor Bledin Jones. What would you have done if you hadn't done medicine, do you think?
Well, I'd probably have been a physicist or a mathematician, I would have thought.
And you wouldn't be talking about cancer therapies.
But I shall avoid physics and equations, but I will tell you quite a bit about the treatment of cancer by physical means with radiation. So we're talking about the cure of cancer, not its palliation or the elimination of the symptoms. We really are trying to eradicate the condition in this talk. Now, this is something that affects us all. There is a 40% chance that all of us may get cancer, even if it is a relatively trivial one on the skin from all those holidays we've had abroad and so forth. But the rates are expected to increase, and as you heard earlier, it's the aging of the population that's really mostly causing that. So two-thirds of cancers at the moment occur in people over the age of 65, but it does occur in children too, and it's the second commonest cause of death in children. The side effects of treatments are well known to be pretty horrendous in the worst case and mild in the best case scenarios. We all know that surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, and various drugs are used to treat cancer, and they're not pleasant. We call the drugs cytotoxic because they kill cells. They are essentially poisons. And surgery can sometimes be debilitating and disfiguring also. So patients are aware of these things, and in fact the Japanese government were very aware of a fear of treatments in the Japanese population because they feared radiation, particularly as a result of the atomic fallout at the end of the Second World War. And indeed in our country also you come across patients who just don't want to have treatment, they fear it so much. Now, the question I'm going to ask you, which form of technology would you like to be used to treat your cancer, should you be unfortunate enough to get one? Would you like to use something going back to the First World War? Efficient? Maybe the Second World War? More reliable? Faster? But would you like something more specific, like in the Falklands War, where we had the Harriers? And what I'm going to talk to you about, particle therapy, is what the Americans call landing the dose on a dime, which is what this plane could do. Or should we go to something even more sophisticated like the stealth bombers and remotely kill cancer targets with very reduced collateral damage, which they can do in the military, and we can now do with very good physics? So that's the basic question. And of course there's international collaboration in all this, like our great production of the Concorde, which was a white elephant in many respects. But what I'm talking to you today certainly isn't in that class, in that sense, because this is very applicable to all the population. So, advances in medical sciences have followed improved technologies and physics in particular over the years. This is at the moment leading to better early diagnosis of cancer with imaging and also chemical tests. And we're finding tumours at a smaller stage when they're more curable. And of course that allows us to use more targeted, specially targeted treatments. And a particular particularly, the imaging now available for cancer is so much better. And I'm going to show you several examples of images of tumours in patients with CT scans. And you can see how that's improved our knowledge of where it is. And if you know where something is, you've got a much greater chance of doing something about it. So this is a slide produced by my colleague, Professor Peach, who's an experimental physicist who spent most of his life at the Hadron Collider at CERN. And there is the cancer. Sorry, I've pressed the wrong button there. But there is the cancer within the body. Let's presume that this is the cross-section of the body. And there's a deep cancer situated in the green dot. Now, what we tend to do at the moment with radiation, we put in X-rays through the patient. And you can see the dose profile here. A LINAC machine, this is a linear accelerator, and there's one in most big hospitals in the country. We have six at Oxford, for instance. The dose is low at the skin and then builds up to a high dose, and then it passes through the whole thickness of the patient. So if I give X-rays to a patient to the chest through my thigh region here, the beam will come out through my spine at the back. Okay? But at a lower dose. So you can see the dose fading away on the grayscale here through the tumour. So basically you've put in more dose this side of the tumour and less on the other side of it. Now to improve the situation, to get more dose to the tumour, you could give more beams. And we do this with fine pencil beams of X-rays these days in some hospitals in the country. And you can focus the dose then to the tumour. You've got more dose here than around there. But there's an awful amount of radiation unnecessarily released to the body with these techniques. So what do we do about it? Well, you've also got to consider the position of vital organs, such as your eye or spine or whatever. And, you know, our bodies are precious in that extent. So what we can do then is to eliminate some of the beams. But even so, there's still a lot of stray irradiation around, collateral irradiation. So can we do better? Well, instead of the X-rays, which is the green dose distribution here, if you use charged particles such as protons, now a proton really is a hydrogen atom stripped of its electron, and it's got positive charge. And when you throw these charges, as it were, when you've got a high-energy accelerator machine that accelerates the protons to over 200 million volts, for instance, it passes through tissues at a much lower dose deposition rate. So you get a lower dose coming in, and then as the particles slow down, they suddenly interact with matter quickly. And that causes what we call the Bragg peak. This was an invention of a British physicist just over 100 years ago. And so this is the proton profile. It's causing this peak of tissue, of tissue dose, exactly where the tumour is, if you adjust the energy of the particle to be appropriate. So with protons, you can use multiple smaller fields to get the same dose to the target. Can we do even better? Well, you could use carbon ions. If you strip six electrons off a carbon, you've got 6 plus charge, and that gives you an even sharper peak and so forth. And the Japanese and the German, our German colleagues are using these ions at the moment. And of course, you can use maybe just 2 shots from one direction. Now, I want you to imagine this is the profile of a brain, if you like, of a child who's got cancer here, and we're treating a high dose to this region here. And as you can see with X-rays from this direction and that direction, I allow quite a lot of dose to be delivered to other parts of the brain. Now, with protons and ions, you can give the same dose or even higher to the target should you wish, but no dose at all to quite a substantial volume of tissue. This would allow the child's brain to grow properly, to develop the regions of the facial bones, for instance, to grow properly. And should the patient develop further cancer in the future in these non-irradiated areas, surgery would be more feasible, for example, because operating in irradiated tissues for a surgeon is quite hazardous, at least for the patient, and it takes a long time for the surgeon as well. But clearly, the other advantage would be no radiation here would mean no risk of future cancer because of radiation exposure for a child. over, say, a 20 to 30 year period. So these changes are quite important. This is the actual example of a tumour at the back of the eye of a child, treated with x-rays in this way. The dose passes through, the inclination of the angle is designed there to avoid irradiating the opposite eye to preserve vision. But the problem is that the optic nerve that carries the visual information comes back to this level here, to that yellow spot. So the entire beam may damage the nerve from the other eye. Moreover, it also irradiates the temporal lobe of the brain here, which is involved with memory and musical appreciation, for example. So again, there would be consequences, functional consequences, from that dose for that individual, I'm afraid to say. Of course, with the proton beam here, the beam just stops because of those Bragg peaks exactly where you want to. There's no risk whatsoever of damaging the vision on the other side. This is another good example. This is a cross-section of a chest. Here are the lungs in the dark colour here of a young lady. She's had a spinal tumour removed. This is a spinal cord there. And this side here is treatment with proton particles, this side with x-rays. Best available x-rays. And as you can see, a high dose can be given to the spinal tumour, yet protect the spinal cord in each case. But the dose passing through the lungs here would mean that that young lady will not be playing hockey for her village side or anything like that in the future, because her breathing will not be as good in terms of and the strain of exercise and so forth as in this case, where the lungs are not really involved, apart from a sliver here. Moreover, the beam is going through her heart, and we know that doses of above 10 gray in this color here do affect the heart, and the risk of a heart attack and so forth goes up over 10 years after the radiation exposure. And it gets worse because the beam is coming out through her breast tissue here, so she's at risk of breast cancer development 20 to 30 years later. And we know that if you irradiate the breast of a younger woman, it's between 20 and 90 times more sensitive in various situations to develop cancer, according to whether you've used chemotherapy or not, for instance. So very good reasons for choosing this, the first plan there on this side rather than that, particularly if it was your daughter or mine. This is the example of a child. Children get these rare cancers. This one originates in the cerebellum of the brain here, and it tends to seed in the spinal cord. We actually treat about 80 children a year in the United Kingdom for this condition with x-rays. You can see the dose passing through in this direction, and this is the dose scale here in colour. And it passes through the heart in this case. All the organs in front of the spine are unnecessarily radiated. And this is in America, where they're using protons and they're cutting off the dose and preventing exposure. Now, if this is a girl, it would prevent exposure of the ovaries and infertility, for instance. So that's important too. Now, to produce these particles, you need an accelerator. This is the smallest synchrotron in the world in a hospital, which opened in 2001 in Japan. The particles are accelerated round and round and then extracted along this beam line. That's all in the basement of this building, and then the particles come up to the roof and are bent through this red magnet here into this cavity in this gantry, as we call it here, where the patient is. Now, the patient actually walks through here, and this is the view of that room, which is situated in the middle of this device. Now, this weighs 300 tons alone, and this costs about 20 million to purchase, for instance. So this is expensive. Now, what can it do? This is in another part of Japan, where a patient has a cancer growing in the kidney. And they've put two carbon ion fields on it, one from that direction, one from that direction. There's no dose exposure of the spine or the small bowel at all. So they've eliminated risk. And there you see the result over the next 5 years of this tumour just gradually being resorbed. And what is amazing, and I didn't think I'd see this in my career, is that kidney continues to function. It's actually functioning from its appearance. And also the alternative for this, in Britain, that kidney would have been removed. Surgery is the only alternative for this. So it's nice to have an option for the patient to say, look, if you're not well enough for surgery, or if your other kidney isn't that well, this could give you a solution to the condition. For older people, this matters as well. This is a patient with a metal hip on one side, and some patients have metal hips on both sides. And if you're unlucky enough to have a prostate cancer between the hips, then it's very difficult to get radiation in a reliable way into the area. So with protons, you can treat with fewer beams, as I showed you in the example earlier. And that means that you can overcome some of the physical problems that exist in some patients. Now, what are the drawbacks? The initial cost, I've hinted already, is high. To have a three-room treatment centre would cost about 60 million or so in this country, in our pound currency. And we would have to import the equipment which is made abroad. A lot of expertise and training would be required. And there is going to be a problem, even in this country, with access to treatments, because we won't have one in this country for a long time. And there will be six centres in Germany, so the score will be 6-0 rather than 4-1 last night, very soon. And the Americans will have 10, 12 quite soon, and I believe there are 20 on the order books in America. The Japanese have 8, with 12 coming along soon. So access is going to be difficult, and I foresee a lot of patients having to go abroad if they would want to have this sort of treatment, which is more analogous to keyhole surgery, in a sense, but in the context of radiation. One of the problems has been in persuading our government over the years has been there's a lack of evidence base for this, because over the years patients were taken to physics laboratories for this. And it was only in 2002 that you had three hospitals in the world with one of these heavy gantries for rotating the beam around a patient. So that means there isn't much evidence out there in terms of follow-up on these patients. All we know that when we visit these centres, the patients get through the treatments extremely well with less side effects and so forth. But getting that evidence base is quite difficult. The slide I showed you of the kidney tumour, there's only been 10 patients in the world treated for kidney cancer with these beams, for instance. So that's not evidence enough to persuade governments and so forth, but it seems to work well in all patients treated. So, what I've shown you is the physics dose distribution, as we call it, evidence for the use of particles rather than X-rays in the treatment of cancer. This should reduce the fear. It should increase the cure rate, because you can dose escalate in many instances. The reduced side effects are clear to be seen when you see these patients and at their follow-up. This, on the whole, improves the patient experience, and we expect better quality of life and be able to work and so forth and contribute to society. We are working on cost effectiveness for this, because when you reduce radiation exposure to a wider area of tissue, that means you can give the treatments in fewer hospital visits. And the Japanese have got this down to 4 visits instead of 38 for a prostate cancer, and 1 visit for a small lung cancer rather than 30 or so with radiation. And the patients can breathe better than if they've had surgery as an alternative for it. So cost effectiveness is being looked at very closely, particularly if the number of hospital visits can come down, and also if we can reduce the cost of the accelerator machines by new technology as well, which I'm not going to go into further at this point. So I would like to see far more patients like this young lady here able to play her music and appreciate it, able to work and so forth. In my career, I've been a cancer specialist for 22 years in the NHS. So many patients at follow-up look very apathetic. They've lost their jobs. I've never seen, for instance, a teacher go back to teach after a brain tumour has been treated, ever. And I would like to see that sort of thing possible in the future with better radiation beams. So you've had a little introduction to that scene this evening. Thank you for your close attention.
Thank you very much. As I said, we love questions, but questions at the end. Right, now we have Dr. Sonia Contera, who is the director of the Institute for Nanoscience, and I assume you're going to talk about nanoscience.
That's right. I'm going to talk about the point of view of a physicist. Professor John was very good at showing you how important it is to get physicists to look at medical problems. I am a physicist. I am working at the Institute of Nanoscience for Medicine to find new treats for many things. And one of the things we've been focusing in the last 2-3 years into find new antibiotics. Of course, we are not only physicists working in the Institute. We're a group, we're a team of physicists, mechanical engineers, biologists, and biomedical scientists. And we're really trying to find new ideas to kill bacteria. And why do I want to do this? Well, I'm going to start from one of the sentences of the beginning of the talk of Professor Fairchild that was showed in the video. He said, now we have antibiotics and we manage to kill infections, and that's why we have much extended lives that we used to have before. So I want to be a bit darker here. That may not be the truth in the 21st century. Bacteria are growing resistant to antibiotics, and we may easily, or maybe hopefully not, see the 21st century going back to pre-antibiotic era. We might face what we call no more antibiotics, what we do now. So we've seen since the year 2000 more and more news about the superbugs. And it's not only MRSA, it's TB. We're having more and more problems trying to kill TB, and it's the soldiers in Iraq are being infected by what has been called the Iraqi bacter that is killing soldiers, and we don't have anything to kill this bacteria. They've grown completely antibiotic resistant and we can't kill them. So this problem is quite tough. Most of the antibacterial agents we use these days are based on usually fungal compounds like penicillin, which is the first thing we found. But bacteria are growing because of many reasons. The use and abuse of antibiotics, when you don't finish your antibiotic course, you're making your bacteria more and more likely to grow resistant. Also the use of antibiotics for cattle, for cows, for pigs, so they grow faster and without disease is creating this problem. It's been also used for agricultural purposes. So all this use and obviously abuse of antibiotics is creating these superbugs. This is how now we're killing bacteria. So if this is a bacterium, this is the typical shape of an E. coli bacterium. So a bacterium is a very special machine. It's just 500 to 2 micron nanometers in size, and they have like a cell wall, different types of cell wall outside, depending on the material, an enormous amount of DNA inside. And the way we usually kill bacteria is by breaking the wall somehow, or preventing bacteria from breaking the wall. This is penicillin, works this way. Or by either interfering with the DNA, the replication, either of the moments of the life cycle of the bacteria. And in this way, we've been very successful. From the 1930s to the 1970s, we created an enormous amount of antibiotics. But because of antibiotic resistance, and because we think we can kill any disease that is an infectious disease, pharmaceutical companies are not investing anymore. They don't see it as a profitable place to. There are many problems with patents, and the result is that we are not investigating enough on new antibiotics. Let me tell you a little bit of the biology and why bacteria are so clever and how they can grow antibiotic resistant. So imagine you have a population of bacteria, when you have an infection here, and some will be resistant to the antibiotic and some will not. If for some reason, because of you're not doing well, your course of antibiotics, or any other reason, some bacteria that are resistant are able to survive the initial stage, they start to reproduce incredibly quickly, and then you create a resistant population. So this is a problem. But the main problem is this rather incredible property of bacteria is that when they grow resistant to an antibiotic, they can transfer the resistance to neighbors' bacteria, and they don't even need to be from the same species. For example, this is what is called the plasmid transfer. They create a small piece of DNA that is encoding for the protein that kills the antibiotic, and they start transferring it to their friends. So you end up with a pretty nasty problem. One typical infection is like, we have very good bacteria in our bodies that let us survive. For example, we have Staphylococcus epidermidis in our skin that is very important for keeping our skin healthy. But because they live with us and they're exposed to a lot of antibiotics, they are antibiotic resistant. So now imagine you get a nasty wound in your eye or somewhere else, and some nasty bacteria get into this wound. You kill them with the antibiotics, but they may come in contact with your Staphylococcus epidermidis and transfers this antibiotic resistance. So you may end up with an MRSA infection that kills you. So there's a growing realization that we have to think about antibiotics in a different way. And as I said before, we're trying to use nanotechnology to kill them. And we're trying to use not only nanotechnology, but the tools that nanotechnology brings us, not only nanoparticles, but the new microscopies, the new way of understanding biology. And we bring in, because with nanotechnology comes the physicists and the engineers, different ways of understanding bacteria. Also because we're using new techniques and because we're looking at the problem in a different way than a biologist would. And of course, we work with biologists and we benefit from all their knowledge over the years, but we want to try new things. So why nano? I'm sure in this very informed audience, everybody knows what is nano. Just a slide to remind people what nano is. So these are the typical sizes of things. This is the macro world, footballs and ants. So when we go to the biological world, we face a macro world with things are micron size. We can see this, 10,000s of nanometers. Red blood cells are 5,000 nanometers, that's 5 microns. Bacteria are 2,000 nanometers. But if we look at the molecular level, we look at DNA, we need the potassium, the membrane proteins, which are the main targets of most diseases of humans, or DNA, which is also one of the main targets of proteins association with DNA. We're looking in this range of 5 to 10 nanometers, 2 nanometers. And nanotechnology has brought to us first the means to create nano objects. The means to modify them, and the way to make them interact with biology. So we have a potential carrier for drugs and a potential new way of interacting with biology. What we hope is that new nanoparticles and these new microscopies will help us to understand the biology that we don't understand right now. There's lots of the biology of bacteria that we don't know. We don't know how they replicate, we don't know how they transfer all these genes. And we're hoping that nanotechnology will bring us the means to understand the biology and to create new drugs and new drug delivery systems. So that's what we're trying to do. Let me introduce you about what has been the focus of my life since I was 20 years old, this atomic force microscope. Atomic force microscope is the beginning of nanotechnology. It's the microscope that let us see nano objects and beyond. And in the case of biology, it's the first microscope that lets you see, in this case, the double helix of DNA in liquid. This is not a crystal structure, this is not a cartoon. We can see DNA, and we can see real DNA. A DNA in a bacterium, for example, you have millimeters of DNA stuck inside a 2 micron object. It's very complicated structure, it's very wound up, it has a lot of energy. We have now the microscopy and the means to understand all this energy, all the physics of DNA. We're trying to understand and see, in this case, membrane proteins. We can see them. We can see them moving. We can study bacteria, how they reproduce with very high resolution, way beyond optical microscopy, membrane proteins and how drugs attack membrane proteins and DNA. So our effort is to use the normal techniques of biology has created over the years, and the new techniques of physics and nanotechnology are bringing about to understand the biology, and the physics of biology, and to create new drugs. So, for example, what I was telling you before, we can see DNA and we can see membrane proteins with very high resolution, and we can design drugs and see what these drugs do to the molecule one by one. We are not guessing anymore. Modern pharmacy industry, they test tons of compounds. They need lots of amounts of things. With nanotechnology, we just need drops of things. We need nanoliters to test new drugs. Because we have these microscopes, we can test drugs in a single molecule. And then, of course, we have to do all the clinical trials and work with animals, perhaps, to test drugs. But the beginning, it's much more clever, in a way. Let me tell you one of the examples of the things we're doing to find the weak points of bacteria. And it's based on a very human thing, which is the way we feel things are soft and hard. Humans, we have evolved to understand how things, we understand our world around, not only with our eyes, but we're very good at knowing if things are soft and hard. Of course, we have our fingers that tell us that, but we also have our ears. When we hit on something, we hear the frequency of that noise, and we know if something is high pitch or low pitch, if it's hard or soft. We want to apply this principle at the nanoscale to find the weak points of bacteria. We're going to be poking bacteria all over the place and say, this is the weak point, and that's the way I'm going to kill you. And we're using the property that you use in guitar strings, actually. When you pulse a guitar string, you excite different harmonics of the guitar. Some of you have studied some music theory. You probably know that the string moves and has these harmonics, and that's the movement of a string of the guitar when you pulse it. So in the same way I was telling you before about this microscope we use, we can make these micro cantilevers with a nanoparticle in the end to hit bacteria, and then we get this movement that is very similar to the string of the guitar to make these maps of the bacterial weak points. So this is a normal bacterium, how we're seeing with a microscope, and this is a map of soft and hard areas in the bacterium. And based on these maps, we're developing drugs that we kill bacteria in the weak points I was telling you before. Right? So that's this bacterial cell mechanics that we are so excited about. This is the point where we know the weak points, we know how to attack them, and then we need to study the basic science. How do we interact with this? How a nanoparticle interacts with a bacterium and also with your bodies? There is a possible problem of nanotoxicity, of course. So we do all sorts of standard biological techniques and these microscopies and all sorts of techniques to know to design these nanoparticles, to design the interactions, to see what is important, for example, in this case, to kill a bacterium, the size, the charge, the shape. And this is obviously a very difficult work to do. And one of the problems of nanotechnology is that we can create nano-objects, but it's very difficult to separate them and to functionalize them the way we want. So we have to do a lot of work in separating them, in creating them, and in making them the way we want. But still, we already have developed a nanoparticle, a nanostructure that we show here in this cartoon, that provokes bacterial explosions. Let me go with you through this picture. This is a bacterium which has been exposed to some of these nanoparticles, and it's been broken here. It's been this is the explosion. This is all the DNA and proteins that is inside the bacteria, and we see how it explodes. So this is an example of how we are developing the new antibiotics. We study the bacterium at the nano level, we find the weak points that could be chemical or physical, and then we design a nanoparticle, and finally we see the effect. And we see the effect with high resolution. We see exactly where we kill it. We're not guessing. And of course, this is difficult. One thing is to find nanoparticles that kill bacteria. And another thing is to actually bring this to the clinic and to actually make safe antibiotics. It's going to take quite a few years. To my knowledge, there's only one company that is having something on clinical trials, and it's part of this effort in the war of Iraq, mainly, to avoid the bacterial resistance that is killing many soldiers. But what we will have very soon is coatings of medical instruments that prevent bacterial adhesion. So we're going to have clean hospitals, hopefully, with these new nano coatings. We're going to have better water and air purification systems. And this is not only useful, for example, in the third world, for people to have clean water, but also to prevent bacterial resistance. Many of the bacterial resistance is happening because we have antibiotics and biocides in our sewage. And we have to filter all this. Another thing that I forgot put in here, in the midterm, within 10 years, nanotechnology will make possible to make a chip that we can put a drop of blood or whatever of the patient, and we will know exactly what bacteria is actually infecting or what collection of bacteria is infecting the patient. And this is very important to choose the antibiotics we want to give to the patient, because each antibiotic acts on different bacteria. And of course, the dream that will come who knows when is that we will have targeted delivery antibiotics that will target a specific bacteria in a specific point of the body. And we will have not only new antibiotics, we have been talking today about bacteria, but antifungal drugs. Right now, we don't have effective drugs against fungi and all other parasites. So nanotechnology, and of course, the collaboration of nanotechnology with existing sciences, we're hoping that it will bring the end to many of these problems. And I cannot avoid talking about nanotechnology in medicine without a slide about all the, of course, the hype perhaps of nanotechnology, or at least all the hopes we have for nanotechnology. Nanotechnology will invade all our lives, from computers to we will probably end up with global warming with nanotechnology to water purification. But of course, we will be designing, using in one way or another nanotechnology, biosensors, imaging. We will, for example, help therapies like Professor Jones was presenting before to even target better all these treatments for cancer, not only for delivering the drug, but to help radiation techniques to actually be more focused. Of course, it will help in stem cell differentiation. One of the things we're learning from nanotechnology is stem cells not only feel chemistry, they feel physics. And this is one of the new things that nanotechnology can bring. And of course, for building new artificial skin systems, new scaffolding, which cells can grow. Of course, artificial eyes, artificial red blood cells, implants that don't fall off after 10 years when you've been put on your teeth, or regenerative medicine, new materials for regenerating wounds and all sorts. And of course, eventually, this will take us to the very controversial topic of enhanced human. One, we can cure everything, and now we know everything about the biology of our body, so quite a lot about it. We will have the power to interfere with it. And that, of course, is an open question about what will be an enhanced human and what we would like it to be. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Baroness Susan Greenfield, Director of the Institute of the Mind. Susan, what would you have done if you hadn't done what you're doing?
Well, I used to do philosophy and classics. And some might say that still underpins a lot of neuroscience. However, we're here to talk about one of the big spectres that faces us in this century. Whilst the diseases we've heard about are, of course, very serious diseases, I think that people in particular fear Alzheimer's because it attacks the very essence of what you are. It's not just a disease of memory, just not being able to remember what you did last Tuesday, not just being able to remember someone's name you met at a party. It's a recapitulation, if you like, of childhood. Just as when you grow and develop so slowly, your brain cells become personalized by making connections that are unique to you, you can imagine what it must be like if, in return, they are slowly dismantled. So you retrace the steps of childhood. You become confused, disorientated, frightened, because you start to lack the checks and balances of the adult mind. So, what can we do about it? Well, it's a very serious problem, as I'm sure everyone here is aware. In the UK, you can see here a healthy brain. Well, it's not healthy anymore. The person's dead, but was healthy once. And on the right, you can see the Alzheimer brain, which you don't have to be a neuroscientist to see is in pretty poor shape. The statistics are there's 700,000 currently in the UK, rising to just under, about 940,000, 1.7 by 2051, and that's an increase of 38% over the next 15 years, an increase of 154% over the next 45 years. So for the younger people in this room, this is already a very serious problem for you to face, whether you yourself get it, whether people that you love get it, or whether you're just a citizen of the mid-21st century, in which case you're going to have to foot the bill for a huge amount of care for the patients. So this is a very serious condition. I would like to stress, however, that it is not a natural consequence of aging. It's a disease of older people. And therein lies our hope. One of the lines of investigation, if you like, starts with this fact, and that is, as you can see, the disease takes a long time to reveal itself, and it exacts, as you may know, 5, 10, 20 years of people's lives. And already, as we know, you can have certain treatments. They don't cure the disease. They just help slow down the symptoms. But nonetheless, that tells us that if we could, in some way, we've heard of Sonia's dream, and this is my dream, if we could somehow get what we call a surrogate marker, if we could somehow get a means of ascertaining beforehand, before the symptoms come on, whether or not someone is destined to have this condition, you can see, you can see, has someone got the marker? Is there a laser here as well? Is this a laser pointer? It's the green one. Okay, fine. Fiendish. Okay. You can see that if you were able to detect that someone was destined to get it, you could start the treatment early, and that would be perhaps even more beneficial. We know, for example, in Parkinson's disease, which is a related condition, as we'll see, that you have to have 80% of cell loss in the relevant area in order for the symptoms to become apparent. You can imagine if you could detect it at 30%, then that would be pretty good if you could start medication that just at least slowed things down. Also, it might sound ghoulish, but you could allow patients and carers to plan ahead, which would be a good thing. And perhaps of most significance, it would reduce the cost of clinical trials, because the patient could be their own basis of comparison, their own control. So again, this notion of developing a surrogate marker, which many have, might not seem that glamorous. It might not seem that this is going to be the catch-all cure, the magic pill that suddenly comes on the market tomorrow. No, it would be nonetheless a very important step forward. And I have a dream. Well, actually, I have two dreams. This is the first one, and then you'll see the second one, which combined might actually be a very effective approach. And the wonderful thing about being at the James Martin School, I don't know if the others have really emphasized this enough, but it can't be emphasized enough, is that what is championed there is the idea of doing novel approaches, going left of field, challenging dogma, and heavens, we need that in science in general and for Alzheimer's disease in particular. So I'm very grateful to be part of this institution that actually encourages new ideas and the challenge of dogma. So what I'm not going to do, I'm sure there's many of you here who are card-carrying neuroscientists or neurologists or psychogeriatricians and so on, I'm not going to just give you the standard review. What I'd like to do in this very short time is share with you the vision. Someone once said the difference between a vision and a delusion is whether people are with you or not. And I like to think that what's it like we're going to look at a vision as opposed to a delusion. Okay, so goal A, we have two goals to this vision. Goal A would be indeed to discover a surrogate marker. Well, some of you may say, well, there's nothing new in that. Lots of people are trying to do that. What I'd like to share with you is our novel idea, and I would like to stress, especially if there are carers in the audience, that this is still at the stage of vision as opposed to reality. But nonetheless, it's work in progress. Okay, we look, as all science does, at cues and clues. And the first clue that we need to think about is this one, shown rather, I think, eloquently by this set of paintings. If you still focus on the top left, this was a painting by someone who was an artist who had a stroke. And he had a stroke, had a lesion in a particular part of his brain that very characteristically only presented with half his body. So when he painted himself, he only painted half a face. But you can see astonishingly, if you look at the remaining pictures, two, three, four, this is over a nine-month period, and you can now see a full recovery as evidenced by the full painting. Now, this is something that we've known for a while, which is that neurodegeneration, therefore, is not a generic property of neurons. How can it be if, when you see a stroke like this, you then actually get a partial or almost complete recovery? My own father had a stroke in the early 90s, and for his 90th birthday party, he had a flying lesson, and he has his driving license back. So that shows you, as I'm sure many of you may be aware, that it's not enough just to be a brain cell, and if you're damaged, you're going to embark on neurodegeneration. It's not that. There must be something special. There must be something special about the groups of brain cells that, if they are damaged, lead to this remorseless, slow death of the cells. So what other clues would we have? Well, I did mention Parkinson's disease briefly, and this is, of course, Michael J. Fox and Muhammad Ali, both victims of that disease, a disorder of movement presenting with rigidity, tremor, and a poverty of movement. Most people would say, of course, that Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease are separate diseases. They're treated with different medications because although they're both neurodegenerative conditions, they present with the need for supplementing different levels of chemical messenger of transmitter. However, what is widely known but rarely picked up as a clue is that often you get a co-pathology. There are some unfortunate people that present with both Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases. And to me, this is again a very important clue that there is perhaps a common mechanism of neurodegeneration. And it's simply cosmetic, this issue of whether you treat with an agent that supplements a transmitter called acetylcholine or another one for Parkinson's that supplements the transmitter dopamine. That's really, I think, trivial and cosmetic relative to the underlying cause of the cell loss, which I think the two have in common. And that's particularly the case if you actually look at where the cells that are prone to neurodegeneration are situated in the brain. For the uninitiated, although I'm sure many of you know this, that's the back of the brain and this is the front and we're looking sideways on. And you can see here this white hub of cells, and it's these that are primary neurons that are prone to either Alzheimer's disease or Parkinson's disease or motor neuron disease. And they form a continuous and rather interesting hub. Moreover, we've known now for about 15 years that they have very different properties to other cells in the brain. For example, they come, if anyone's an embryologist here, from the basal plate rather than the alar plate. And if you have a different embryonic provenance, then that does suggest you may be destined to be very different from the other cells in the brain. And so it turns out to be the case. And my own suggestion is if we start to study these cells, which are so vulnerable and are the key cells lost in Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, they may all reveal their secret. They may reveal why they, and unlike the others, they embark on neurodegenerative process. Well, what's very interesting is if you actually look at the transmitters, and I won't belabor you with the transmitter names here, but you could appreciate the different colors, you can see that transmitters are not the answer, as I've said. These are cells that use different chemical messengers, transmitters. When they die, those transmitter levels will fall, so you'll supplement them with agents such as Aricept or L-Dopa, which I'm sure you've heard of. But that's not really tackling the nature of the problem, and that's the difficulty with current medication. It doesn't actually solve why these cells are dying, nor does it stabilize cell loss. If only we had something in these cells, something that was common to them, something that was fundamental to the loss of the neurons, the neurodegenerative mechanism, and if only we could measure that in the blood, that would be the surrogate marker that we would want. And as you can see, having set it up like that, this is what we think we're onto. So let's look at the cues. First, there's a copathology with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and indeed motor neuron disease. What we have discovered is a common protein in all these so-called global neurons. They're called global because they're like fountains in the brain. They outreach to very remote and distant parts of the brain. They don't subserve little local circuits, as anyone who still thinks the brain's like a computer may still try and persuade you they do. They don't. It's big fountains. So there's a common protein irrespective of the transmitter to all of these. And moreover, we've shown that this protein is released, and that's important because it means it's not just doing something to maintain the single neuron. What it's doing is acting as what we call a signaling molecule to actually send messages, to actually do something among the whole population. And moreover, what we've also discovered, this is kind of 30 years' work in one slide, is that the protein has what is called a trophic action. That's to say it helps cells to grow. Let me show you a picture of that. Again, you may think that this is a rather kind of dreary thing to be looking at on a hot summer's evening, but if you just look carefully, I hope you can see that whilst these cells have some processes coming out of them, these have far more, because this protein that we found, if you apply it to cells, helps them to grow more. Helps them to grow more. Okay, so what could that do? Well, the way they help them to grow is by letting calcium in, but what we've also shown, and what is also well known, is that calcium is a good friend but a deadly enemy. Although it can promote the growth of cells, which is what you want, under certain conditions it becomes a Jekyll and Hyde. So you can see, sorry I keep doing that, so you can see here that if you enhance the dose of an agent that lets in calcium, then if you look at the processes, they're called neurites, both their outgrowth and their density, you can see that in relatively low doses, it's just what you want. That's fantastic. It's causing them to grow. But look what happens. If you increase the dose, your good friend has become your enemy. We talk about a trophic toxic axis. And this is because calcium, once it's overloading into cells, can do a lot of pernicious things. I won't trouble you with that. Now, what's very interesting is this picture can emerge not just if you enhance the amount of calcium or cause too much duration, but actually if the cells are older. In embryo cells, the tolerance to calcium is far greater than in mature adult cells. You may see where this is headed now. Now, what we've done is to have identified the actual key molecular fragment, because proteins are very big and very cumbersome agents. What we've done is to identify a bit on the end, which we'll call the fragment, that indeed seems to be the responsible part of this molecule that will let calcium into the brain cell. So here we have a picture of the fragment at work, where we've shown that you have an agent that stimulates a little molecular target on a cell, we call it a receptor, which will let in calcium in the way that we've just seen. So here goes the calcium. But what we've discovered is this fragment, which is a kind of sidekick. It binds to a what's called an allosteric site, a side bit, which if that then comes along, now, it doesn't do anything on its own, but you can see it enhances the calcium. It causes more calcium to go in, which in certain circumstances is just what you want, but in others, of course, it's going to tip the balance and become toxic, as you can see here. So on the left again, we have the standard cell, and here you can see these cells are in very bad shape. They've got no little branches or anything at all, because our fragment has proved toxic. So, what I'd like to suggest to you is the underlying mechanism of neurodegeneration. Again, this is just our own idea, but there's not that many ideas out there as to the fundamental basis of why cells embark on this remorseless cell loss. Imagine these cells are damaged. Unlike other cells, because they are different generically from all the other cells in the brain, they come from a different part of the embryo, they have retained a special property to actually grow again. And they do so by releasing this special chemical. But in adult cells, the problem is that the very mechanism they've activated to let calcium in is actually toxic rather than trophic, because it's in an inappropriate context. So that means more cells are killed, and the very attempt to try and compensate and grow has actually become deadly. And so more cells are damaged, and you embark on this pernicious cycle, which we recognize as neurodegeneration. So if only we could measure that fragment in the blood, that would be fantastic, and that's what we're trying to do right now. Now, we then come to the other dream. It might be fine to, it would be great to have an early marker. It would certainly bring down the cost of clinical trials, and eventually that's what we want to do, isn't it? We want in the end, of course, to stop any more cells dying. That's the whole name of the game. Wouldn't it be wonderful, you can see here, if despite the fact that you've got the clinical improvement with medication, that nonetheless you say, right, enough already. Enough, that's it. Okay, you may not get your brain back as it used to be. You may have movement problems now if you're Parkinsonian, you may have memory problems now, but if you take this medication, it's not going to get any worse. And as those of you who are in the business will know, that would be, again, something that would just be a miracle for all the sufferers and carers that are currently with us. How could we do that? Well, let's go back to the model that we've seen. Here we have, again, our standard agent. Stimulating the receptor, the target, letting in the calcium. But now, let's block the fragment. Let's stop that coming in and letting any more calcium go in. Wouldn't that be a good thing to do? So that's what we have tried to do, and you can see here, again, the normal so-called control condition, the toxin at work, but now, if we apply this blocker, you can see the toxin can no longer do its business. The cells are as they were. So let's try and combine those things. Let's put those two cures, those two scenarios together. First, imagine that you can detect a marker in the blood before the symptoms appear. This would be wonderful because you could plan ahead, you could start on existing medication, as we've said, and it would help with drug development. Now let's think of another scenario, B, that you can go to the doctor, you already have these conditions, and they say, right, we've got a nasal spray or an oral medication, and if you take that, then your symptoms will not get worse, you will just stay stable as you are. But imagine, and this is the vision, imagine if you could do the two things. Imagine you go to the doctor for a routine blood test. I'm sure many of you go and have cholesterol tests, for example. I certainly do. You go to the doctor for a blood test, routine, and he or she says to you, well, I'm afraid there's good news and bad news. The bad news is your surrogate marker is already elevated, and I can predict by my charts here that in 1 or 2 years you're going to be in a wheelchair or you're going to have severe cognitive problems. But the good news is we now have a medication that stops any more cells dying. So if you take it right now, before the symptoms come on, then you'll have a permanent prevention of the symptom onset. And whilst that's not a cure, whilst it would mean that people would have to have routine blood tests every few months and they'd have to take medication every day, just think how fantastic that would be. And that's what we're trying to do. And I will stress that we're still at very experimental stages. It's not going to happen tomorrow. But we do see a way forward. And thanks to the philosophy of the school in which we are all working, one's able to actually develop this highly novel and inevitably controversial work. I just want to end with wider implications. Obviously, we can go beyond Alzheimer's and Parkinson's to motor neuron disease, Lewy body dementia, and all the other range of neurodegenerative conditions. I published one paper. I had one very tentative voyage into the world of non-neuronal tissue once and looked at breast cancer cells in collaboration with Imperial College, and we found that indeed this fragment does a similar job as it does on neurons to breast cancer cell lines, the more metastatically active ones being the most sensitive. So it strikes me that perhaps this is a very basic systems for cell division that we have here. It's a signaling molecule that binds to a ubiquitous receptor target that might actually be operative in other systems as well. And finally, if that's the case, one of the big problems in biology is how come the immune system, the endocrine system, and the central nervous system can all seem to work together, because they must do, otherwise you'd have biological anarchy. Something must exist that is trilingual that can actually work between these three systems. And this is a good candidate for such a system. So without trying to sell as I'm solving, you know, any minute it'll say solve recession, the peptide will do in event. It's not going to solve the economic crisis any day soon or global warming. But I think that in terms of biology, it may be that we are working with a very fundamental and widespread signaling system. But all we can do is carry on with our particular focus. But I welcome again the chance to work with the other institutes, for example, the Cancer Institute eventually, and stem cell institutes, because it's only by doing that that you can go beyond your own comfort zone and work together to actually realise the truly big vision. Thank you very much.
Thank you very, very much. Questions? There will be microphones circulating. Hands raised, please. Are ready over there. Thank you. Microphone for you.
Professor,
could you
Greenfield.
Say who you're going to address the question to and who you are?
To Professor Greenfield, please. Sorry, this isn't. I know this.
Hi. Oh, you're there. Hi.
I know your talk was much more about the direction of, development of cures or preventive technologies. But just kind of your first couple of slides looked at how many cases of Alzheimer's we might see in the future. Those numbers are huge. How is it going to increase so much, or why?
Why is it increasing so much?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you hear me all right? Is my mic on? Yeah. Basically, as great advances are being made with heart disease and with cancer and with TB, they're no longer the fears that, for example, in my mother's generation caused death among many. We're living longer and healthier lives. You know much more about preventative medicine and healthier lifestyles. So the population is everyone admits aging. A child born now has a life expectancy of living to 100 probably. So therefore, these diseases, which previously were masked by diseases that occurred earlier in life, are now coming to the fore. There's other factors that some people think may be at issue. Stress is considered a factor with Alzheimer's disease. One could argue that if individuals live alone, they're not being stimulated, and the brain loves rehearsing and doing and interacting with people and things, and it may be that that's also an issue. But primarily, it's unfortunately the one bad side of our good lifestyles that people are aging, and that's what I think is really important. We have to focus on having not just a healthy body, but a clear mind, because there's no point otherwise. Well, there may be a point, but it's not as rewarding if you don't know, you don't recognise your nearest and dearest.
Right. Gentleman over here. Wait a second for the microphone.
Professor Sonia, Susan at least. Firstly, Susan. Parents say to their kids, don't use mobile phones. Should we as adults reduce our mobile phone usage because it affects our brain and potentially can give us Alzheimer's? And the other question to Dr. Sonia's, where is this microscope that can see such tiny things like DNA?
Okay, so the issue of mobile phones. There's an interesting distinction when people say absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. So at the moment, most people would say there is no clear evidence that mobile phones causes this. That's not to say that it's not the case. Most scientists will always say, as far as we know, or there is no evidence for that reason. Now, I also find the philosophy quite interesting if you compare it, say, with GM food consumption. People will say, I'm not going to eat GM foods until someone proves they're safe. I will use my mobile phone until someone proves it's dangerous. Yeah? There's an interesting factor there that's beyond the biomedical in terms of human nature and what that is. So basically, I can't give you an unequivocal yes or no answer. I think, as always in life, you have to weigh up what the benefits are, what the potential risks you may perceive to be, because there's very little in life that is without risk that's worth doing.
I'd be curious your view, Professor Jones.
Well, I use them as least as possible, actually.
Is that because you don't like them?
Sparingly. Well, I really don't think we know. You know, even a slight heating effect within the adjacent brain will unwind DNA, and your DNA is more susceptible then to carcinogenesis or to the chemicals that are noxious, which are happening all the time. These are antioxidant sort of oxidation products that occur normally. So I'm very guarded about them, actually. And I have seen a lot of patients with brain tumours in their 20s, 30s that have been heavy users, but that's no proof.
When would one start to see something, if there was a real effect?
Well, I think you'd be talking about a 30-year latent period for brain tumours, right, of that are naturally slow-growing.
And the question of the microscope is very easy to answer in my lab at Oxford. You're welcome to have a look. How big? Oh, very small. The microscope itself is like this, but we need an enormous hood to actually prevent from noise coming inside. But the microscope is this big. We do nano. We don't need big things.
Yes, lady down here.
Yes, I have a question for Professor Jones in relation to the particle therapy. What is the consideration in relation to cancers which are not responsive to radiation therapy? And looking at what you were showing in relation to X-ray generally, would this be effective potentially in metastatic cancer as well?
Yes, I believe it would, at the right price, of course, because if you give the treatment in one shot, you could eliminate growth activity for a very long period of time in a metastatic tumour with less collateral dose against surrounding regions. So it may be possible then, for instance, to retreat the tumour several times. Going back to the resistance question, if I didn't go into the physics of the dose deposition characteristics, the carbon ions and the protons at the Bragg peak deposit energy much more closely together. And that means the DNA in the cells that we repair continuously at low-level damage rates all the time, we all have enzymes to do this in the cells, those would be rendered ineffective because the lesions in the DNA are so close together. Now, in a sense, if you use the carbon beam, they've used it a lot in Japan in radio-resistant tumours themselves, primary tumours of the liver called hepatoma, tumours of the skull basin of the bones, and they're getting far better tumour control than the Americans are, even with protons at the moment. And they're adding chemotherapy as well to it and so forth. So the quality of the radiation is much more intense locally. So it's more difficult for the cell to mount a resistant response, if you like, to it.
Question down here. Oh, question up there. Sorry, we'll get to you in a moment.
It's a question for Professor Greenfield. You reassuringly told us that neurodegeneration isn't the destiny for all neurons, but I wondered what it was about healthy people. You described the protein that allows the calcium to go in and the fragment that's the baddie. Is it that people who don't get Alzheimer's don't have the fragment, or do they have an entirely different protein?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Yes, they do have the fragment, and they do have the protein. It's how it's mobilized and the context in which it's used that's the key issue. Yeah. So one could imagine what's called an insult to the brain under various circumstances. You could have a stroke in that area, you could have a blow to the head, as often is the case. You could have a decline in something called scavenging mechanisms, which mop up these molecular rambos called free radicals. Yeah? So any of those things could lead to death of brain cells. If it happens to be in that hub of cells, then the system will kick in. So, as you may be aware, only 5% of Alzheimer's disease has a strong genetic link, because genetic, the other is so-called sporadic. Yeah. So my own view is that there's many causes. All you would need is death of those crucial cells, and then the system would start to do its nasty job.
There was a question down here.
Dr. Quintero, when you were showing one of your slides with a bacterium having an explosion, I found myself wondering if you would describe that bacterium as alive. And then I wondered if there's a broadly accepted definition of what life is amongst scientists.
No, there's not. It's still a controversial topic. Yeah, bacterium is alive, I suppose. It reproduces. It passes antibacterial resistant genes to friends. Bacteria is alive. An exploded bacteria, we hope, is not alive because it's not able to reproduce anymore. But there's no, when you go to very small scale, it's very difficult to define what is alive, even for a virus.
Yeah, you can, I love that question. There's some wonderful work in Germany going on by someone called Peter Fromhertz, where he's growing brain cells on silicon chips, yeah? Because neurons are brilliant electronic components. They've had the whole of evolution to develop capacitance properties and so on. So they can actually work in conjunction with their nearest relatives with silicon. So that actually does challenge our traditional way we're brought up to say, well, life is all about carbon. Yeah? Because you could have neurocomputers in the end, which is quite an exciting thought. Yeah.
Yes, the lady over there.
Thank you. This may be the stupidest question ever. Sorry, don't judge me. But the number you showed of people with Alzheimer's by the time I'm about 60 will probably be more than people I've ever set eyes on in my life. Is there something you can do, just do, to stop that by the time my children are my age?
Okay, that's not a stupid question at all. I'm asked that virtually every day by taxi drivers, dentists, you know, whenever you say what you do. That's the first question they, of course, ask. As you may know, people like Iris Murdoch and Bernard Levin, who are brilliant intellectuals, were sadly victims of that condition. On the other hand, I think there's things you can do. You can exercise your brain as much as possible. There's been a great vogue in various computer games and so on, and I endorse one of them even, but my own view is that rather than do that, you might as well do something useful and interesting, like learn a language and go out and have an argument with someone or something. You know, I think that's, so I'm not knocking doing the screen check, but you might as well do a real thing rather than an artificial thing, and something that's a benefit and of fun. Yeah? So you can do those things because the way the brain works is it's a bit like a muscle. The more you use it, the stronger it will get. But it's a bit like saying if you go running a lot, you'll never get a heart attack. It may help. It may help get your body in the best condition possible so you don't get one, but it won't guarantee you don't get one. So my own suggestion is be as active as possible with your mind. Yeah? So in my own thing, I love learning language, for example. Learning languages is very good, or having arguments. But the main thing is not to just sit passively in front of a screen saying yuck and wow and yuck and wow. You know? The whole idea is to actually get out there and ask questions and try and link things up. And even if you get Alzheimer's, at least you'll then have had a rewarding life beforehand, you know, so, rather than just wasting it.
Question over here. Sonia, do you think, just before that question, but do you think there's anything that nanotechnology will be able to offer Alzheimer's? Or
it's already doing it. Right. One of the things we actually have done it in the lab is to see at a single molecule level, for example, this beta amyloid that may or may not be related with the disease and in what way it's actually doing to cells. And we can see one by one, one molecule, what it's actually doing to a cell. So it's already been applied.
Right. Yeah. Lady.
Do you think that diet has an influence on getting Alzheimer's? Can we do something about it?
Wouldn't that be nice if that was okay? Okay, certainly, when you think about diet, you have to think about making up for a deficiency that you might have that might be causing a problem, yeah? As opposed to taking some superfood that is going to give you some wonderful transhumanist property. For example, we know that because of these nasty free radical things, that rise in older age because we lack the mechanisms, the defense mechanisms to combat them. If you take antioxidants like vitamin E or vitamin C, that can help combat free radicals. But that doesn't mean to say that by taking foods rich in vitamin E or vitamin C, you're going to not have that disease. But it means if there is a deficiency that you have, you'll make it possibly you're not going to help yourself by not having that. So it's a rather crucial sort of balance. A very close colleague of mine works with fish oils, and he's convinced that fish oils help with a whole range of things relating to dyslexia and visual pathways and so on. So there's a lot of investigation into deficiencies and how they can be supplemented, but I'm somewhat suspicious about taking superfoods thinking that's going to make you super clever. I think that that's a, you know, you mustn't go the other way.
You taking anything?
No. Bananas. Bananas are rich in serotonin, so anyone who suffers from depression, they might be easier than Prozac to take.
Yeah. Right, okay.
One idea.
Gentleman over there.
Yeah, hi. This is a question for Baroness Greenfield. With the increasing prevalence of Alzheimer's disease, do you think the cost of treatment when the drug becomes readily available, do you think the NHS could actually, you know, spend it on all the patients who really need it, or do you think it's going to be obstructive?
Yeah, this is a really difficult question, and I'm sure many people will be familiar with the controversy with NICE and Aricept, which is not available to NHS patients, and that it might buy you 6 months more of recognizing your grandchildren. And so therefore, one part of the controversy has been, will it be that only middle-class people can have a better quality of life, and meanwhile, those who are succumbing to it will be put off to social services. And so this is a real issue. On the other hand, we do not, especially at the moment, have a bottomless pit of money. What I would like to see, and this is sidestepping your very good question, is I would like to see more money put into research. When you think about money spent on defense, for example, you know, we scientists are very cheap to keep. You know, we don't. Yes, you say. I'm sure the whole panel agree. We don't require much, and yet what we can deliver, if we're given the chance and the environment, could actually mean that that would make a very big difference to the expenditure of what it is. But it is a really difficult issue. Let me just tell you one story about Alzheimer's. There's a man called Clive, and he had early onset, and the wife came home one day and found that he was quarreling with his four-year-old over the chocolate biscuit. Just think of that. And if you could have said to her, look, if you take this medication, that's not going to happen for a while. You know, at what price do you put on that quality of life? And I can't come up with a facile answer to that, but it's something that the younger people in this room are going to have to really think about. But my own suggestion is, please put more money into research, because only by backing research will we get out of this gridlock.
It did occur to me when you were talking, and particularly when you saw that spectacular piece of equipment, you thought, really, is the NHS ever going to pay for such a thing?
Well, they made an announcement, actually, last August, although none of the newspapers reported it on the following day or week, that they would fund proton therapy in the NHS in around 2014 onwards. And so far, seven cities have bidded for proton therapy. The NHS will supply revenues per patient, but not the capital cost of the equipment. So it's up to trusts to find that money on the open
market. Someone in the audience.
So benefactors are urgently required in many cities, but we really don't know how many will be allowed. Maybe three, at a guess.
Are you a cheap date then, Sonny?
I am very cheap.
Nano cheap. The gentleman over there.
Dennis Siegel. This is for Dr. Gontera. Would you like to comment on the progress in mycotoxicosis? Because the medical establishment was very slow in recognizing the problems concerned with mycotoxicosis. And knowledge of it went back as far as about 1929 among indigo planters in southern India.
Yeah.
So I think the medical establishment was...
there is a big problem
very
with...
Very slow in recognizing
the problem. Fungal infections are very difficult to cure, and we don't have good medicines for them. That's the truth. One of the things we're working more actively in my lab is that, how to kill fungi and how to kill bacteria. The problem with fungi is that they have a very slimy, crusty cell wall that is almost impossible to penetrate. And we're hoping that with our new techniques, we'll understand better this wall that is resistant to classical biochemical analysis, for example, and that we can find maybe more physical ways to kill fungi. But it's still very difficult to get funding, and we're going back for the same thing. We're having very different ideas of what bacteria and fungi are from traditional biologists or medical doctors. And we kill them in the lab. We see that our work is promising, but it's difficult to convince research councils to actually invest in these new ideas. Everybody's talking about nanotechnology, multidisciplinary research, but when it comes to actually fund the type of research that we would need and we think is very promising, the establishment is very conservative, and only very traditional ways are funded. And in this way, the James Martin School has been very useful for us. Yeah.
Okay, a couple more questions, I think. Yes, sir, gentlemen.
This is a question for all the speakers, including the one that's absent. to play the skeptic, proton therapy has been around for at least 3 decades. It really hasn't been shown to work effectively during that time. Why is it going to work now? Stem cell therapy has been around for nearly 4 decades. There are some trials showing that it does work for a limited period, but if it really was going to work, why hasn't it worked by now? Neurodegenerative markers have been around for at least a couple of decades. If they were going to go from marking to blocking to therapy, why haven't they done it by now? Finally, nanotechnology has been around for at least a couple of decades, and if those really small particles really work, why haven't they worked on bacteria now, and why aren't they working in the clinic?
Okay, I think she'll start on the right.
Right. Yeah. The history of it is fascinating, because proton therapy was used 30 years ago in physics laboratories, as I suggested earlier. The beams came through holes in the wall, and they were horizontal beams. The patients were treated in dental chairs. If you did use CT scanning, you had to ask the company to produce a vertical CT scanning. The imaging quality was hopeless, and they treated rare tumors only. So it is only since about 2002 that you've had 3 hospitals in the world with a proper gantry to get proper angles on the treatment, high enough energies also to hit the depth for the tumors. So I think medically the whole history starts in 2002 onwards, and we'll need probably 20 years of making the evidence base. Interestingly, we started the whole thing in a hospital, first of all, in Liverpool, on the Wirral Peninsula at Clatterbridge, where I was working at the time. And indeed, they've now treated over 2,000 patients for ocular melanoma in the eye, a malignant tumor of the eye. And the problem there was that we only had a cyclotron with 60 million volt energy that gave a Bragg peak at 3.5 centimeters range, so we couldn't treat anything deeper. But that's been an unqualified success story. There's never been press releases about it, because it's all been done within the National Health Service, not by cancer charities. And they don't go to the press about these successes, as it were. So I'm expecting a lot of good news on this front from particle therapy used in hospitals with proper equipment to do the job properly. And don't forget what I said about the imaging. We do know where the targets are now. The treatments given 30 years ago were a bit of a joke, really, because you didn't really know where the cancer was. You just assumed it was somewhere, relative to X-ray bony anatomy.
Right. Sonia, you basically have been working since you're 20 at it. Why aren't you cracked the problem yet?
No. I've been working since I was 20 in developing the techniques to actually have these microscopes that you can see single molecules. The image I show you today of the exploded bacteria, basically we got it about 2 months ago. You were about the first audience that have seen this. I had problems showing this because obviously we want to patent this. We don't know much about what happens with nanoparticles and bacteria, and we don't know much about what happens with nanoparticles in human bodies. So it's all very emerging research, and we don't know much. No, I completely...
honest.
Susan.
Okay, you're right and wrong. You're right about markers being around for a long time, but they are not
the right kind of markers. As I think I said at the beginning, it's not a novel idea that wouldn't be great if we could detect something in the blood. On the other hand, the candidates that have been previously touted have been indirect markers that reflect perhaps general aging or more generalized cell death rather than the underlying mechanism. The big problem until now with neurodegeneration isn't so much how you could combat it, but to know what it is you're combating. It's a bit like, for those of you who like analogies, a bit like saying, once you know who your enemy is, you can shoot them. But until you know who the enemy is, however good your gun, you're not going to be able to do very much. And what I think has been lacking up until now, and what we're trying to do, is to actually identify the enemy, actually to get the pivotal mechanism, not just a downstream, and forgive me, I think amyloid's downstream, downstream agents, but things that are actually causing those special cells to die. If we knew that, then we would have a sensitive and faithful marker, which until you know that, you can't get a marker, obviously.
I'm afraid that question ends this session. Thank you very much to the speakers.